Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, December 11th, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we'll be discussing the new book, Power Wars, Inside Obama's Post-9/11 Presidency. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome two experts to our call today. I'm going to introduce Paul Rosenzweig. He's the principal at Red Branch Law and Consulting right here in the Washington, D.C. area. He's a return guest. I'm going to leave it to him to moderate our event and to introduce our special guest, the author of the book I just mentioned. They'll be engaging in an interview and a conversation between the two of them, but as always, we'll be getting to the audience for your questions, so please do have those in mind when we get to that portion of the program. With that, Mr. Paul Rosenzweig, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Dean, and welcome everybody who's listening. My name is Paul Rosenzweig, and I'm joined today by Charlie Savage. It is customary, of course, to provide an introduction of your guest, but I suspect that Charlie doesn't really need much of an introduction to the listeners on this call. Anybody who is interested in national security law and policy, perforce has had the opportunity to learn much of what they know and much of what they didn't know from Charlie over the years. Charlie has formerly been a Boston Globe reporter and is currently the Washington correspondent for the New York Times. While at the Boston Globe, he won a Pulitzer Prize for national reporting for his earlier book, Takeover, The Return of the Imperial Presidency and the Subversion of American Democracy, which was about the intersection of national security law and national security policy in the Bush administration. Today, we are pleased to get together to talk about his new book, Power Wars, Inside Obama's Post-9/11 Presidency, which is essentially a reprise of that theme in a different strain, a look at national security law and policy in the Obama administration. Charlie, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
It's good to have you here. So let me toss you the early softball. At a 10,000-foot level, what's this book about, and why did you write it?
Well, so as you mentioned, I've been writing about legal policy and national security in particular for some time. My first book, alas, did not win a Pulitzer, but I did get a Pulitzer for some articles I'd written about executive power in the Bush administration. And I've continued to get deeper and deeper into this topic. I've been writing about it since 2003 now, and eventually began co-teaching a course at Georgetown University on national security and the Constitution. And in the midst of that, the Snowden leaks happened, and it occurred to me around that time that the material I was trying to help my students understand, combined with the fairly good sources I had among current and former Obama administration officials, could be married up into what could be a very useful book, I thought, which would both explain to an educated but not necessarily specialist audience what are these issues that keep recurring in the post-9/11 world where the rules were not written for these situations, whether it's laws of war that were written for 20th century uniformed armies meeting on a battlefield being applied to an armed conflict against a non-state actor that flows around into ungoverned spaces where the United States does not have troops on the ground, or whether it's surveillance laws written for analog circuit-based telephone systems being applied to the internet, which works very differently. Over and over again, the rules are unclear. What the law actually requires is unclear, and that has led across this whole range of issues, detention, prosecution, surveillance, secrecy, and so forth, to continuing frictions and continuing debates and dilemmas. So I wanted to explain those things and also use my sourcing to kind of go behind the scenes and tell stories so that this wouldn't just be about abstract exposition, but it would be events happening in the world and you're the reader are sort of a fly on the wall in the Situation Room or the Justice Department or wherever, as actual people are grappling with the problems that they that happened and disagreeing with each other and working through these dilemmas that illustrate these recurring frictions. And then finally, I hoped that the book would at least provide readers with the tools to answer or at least understand this era, to have an intelligent debate about some of the biggest issues raised by the Obama presidency in the national security sphere, chief among them being that he had run for office as this liberal law professor, instructor, saying he was going to change George W. Bush's global war on terror. And with the exception of torture policy, he ended up continuing many, many policies as they existed at the end of the Bush years that he had inherited. And that continuity, I think, surprised many people, both on the left and the right, because it created such a gap between what was happening and the expectations created by his campaign rhetoric. And so I was trying to answer the question, what happened and why?
Well, that's actually a good lead into to what was going to be my first question. One of the overarching themes of the book is the similarity in outcome between Bush-era policies and Obama-era policies, again, with the exception you noted about torture policy, and yet a dissonance, it seems, in legal reasoning and rhetoric between the two institutions. So couple questions that come from that for me. The first is, does it matter? Does it matter at all how we speak about these problems from your perspective, from the perspective you've of the people you've interviewed, if we wind up in essentially the same place nonetheless? So that's the first question that I have. And then the second is, what accounts for the continuity? Was it that the president didn't understand the problems he was running into and he got an education in reality? Or was it something else that explains the fundamental continuity between the two presidencies? So
let me start with the second question first. So one of the takeaways that I explore in the book, without necessarily casting judgment about whether this is a good thing or a bad thing, but looking at it as an explanation, is that when people say Obama is acting like Bush, and they're obviously thinking about things like he's using drones to kill people and he's continuing to hold people at Guantanamo without trial, even if he succeeded in closing Gitmo as he wants to do, his solution is to move those same prisoners and hold them somewhere else without trial. And so the legal authority would be the same. He revived and sort of entrenched the use of military commissions and on and on and on. This is what Obama is acting like Bush comes from, these policy outcomes, that meme. And what I'm trying to do is to explore a little more carefully what it means to act like Bush. And that leads to the insight that it's easier to see today than it was during the Bush years, that when liberals and libertarians on the right as well were criticizing the Bush administration for its response to 9/11, for the policies that it followed, there were two different strands to that criticism that were often intertangled with each other, but were in fact quite distinct. One is, I call, the rule of law critique, and one is the civil liberties critique. So the civil liberties critique says that it is inherently wrong for the government to wiretap without warrants on U.S. soil because the state should not have that power vis-a-vis the individual in a democracy. The rule of law critique is agnostic about whether a policy like that is in fact good or bad, or may even be necessary given the problems of the 21st century, but is worried about the legal authority by which the president put it into place. The president, over and over again in the first term of the Bush administration, blew through statutory and treaty constraints based on a theory that the president as commander-in-chief cannot be bound by such things in the national security arena. And the rule of law critique rejects that theory, at least in the most sweeping form that it was advanced early in the Bush administration, and says if this policy becomes necessary and this statute blocks it, the president does not get to blow through that policy. The president must go to Congress and persuade lawmakers to change the law so that it authorizes rather than forbids what the president wants to do. And the difference between those two critiques, rule of law and civil liberties, is that the rule of law critique is fixable. Congress can change federal law so that going forward, what the government is doing is authorized rather than forbidden by statute. And that, of course, happened up and down the chain in the second term of the Bush administration, whether it was Congress passing laws like the Military Commissions Act or the FISA Amendments Act, or as we now know, but did not know in the public at the time, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court adopting some creative interpretations of statute to permit bulk data collection. Things that were operating unilaterally became authorized by statute, at least on the surface. Obviously, people disagree about the Patriot Act interpretation. And so the result of that was that by the time Obama took office, the rule of law problem had largely been fixed. The civil liberties problem, if there was one, remained. And then part two of that analysis is that Obama, obviously, is a lawyer, and Joe Biden is a lawyer, and they surrounded themselves with lawyers in policymaking roles, a national security advisor, and you know, they're both of their secretaries of state and several White House chiefs of staff, and on and on and on. The current counterterrorism advisor, Lisa Monaco, a lawyer. And so their mindset was overwhelmingly such that they were prone to view the problem of Bush as a rule of law problem, not as a civil liberties problem. And if you go back and you look through what Obama was saying during the campaign, and the book tells many stories about that and the early sort of 2009 era, you see that theme playing out over and over again, where he was, if you parse his words carefully, he was critiquing Bush through a rule of law lens, not through the civil liberties lens that many of his supporters and detractors thought they were hearing.
So does that matter? I mean,
does it matter?
Yeah, I mean, in the end, I think that's a good description. But in the end, if say for the one exception we've kind of bracketed, President Obama gets to the same place every time, and does so even in areas like drone attacks where the congressional authorization is sketchy, or he hasn't had the kind of post hoc affirmative authorization that you talk about in say the FISA Amendments Act. You know, does that really make a difference?
So this is something that I, just as an observer, struggled with too. The way I put it sometimes is, if the first term Bush legal team was asked by the White House, can we do X, and they write a one page memo that says, yes, you can do X because you're the commander in chief. You know, let's get lunch. And then the Obama legal team is asked, can we do X? And they write, take months, and they write the 100-page memo that goes into all the permutations and has all the right citations and footnotes and raises all the obstacles and wrestles with them and worries about them and says, well, we couldn't always do X, but maybe in this very limited circumstance in front of us, yes, you can do X. Does that make a difference? Because as you said, at the end of the day, the government is still doing X.
X, yeah.
Yes. And so when I was talking to the people that I was interviewing during the course of the research of this book, and I talked to over 150 current and former Obama administration officials, I often asked that, what do they say? And the answer was, and I report this to you without judgment, was yes, it makes a difference, and here's why. One, the process is an end to itself. When you blow off the law by just adopting this sort of one-size-fits-all get-out-of-jail-free card, as Jack Goldsmith called it, of Article II override, you're not really wrestling with, in a robust way, the issues that you want to think through before you make a decision. So, okay, part two, it also makes a difference because sometimes the lawyers do say no, and then you don't do that thing.
Give me an example of that.
Well, most obviously, Guantanamo is still open, right? It wouldn't be if there weren't statutory restrictions. We'll see whether that status quo remains through the end of this administration, but for now, that's the case. There are lesser examples in the national security realm. The last prisoner in Iraq, a guy named Doc Duke, they wanted to keep in custody and couldn't figure their way towards a legal way to do it, and so they turned him over to the Iraqi government, which let him go. They were very unhappy about that. Outside of the legal realm, in the immigration policy, the they wanted to, in part of the Obama deferred action, executive actions, provide deportation relief to parents of so-called Dreamers, people who are not citizens but were shielded from deportation because they were brought here as children. And the Office of Legal Counsel said that could not be done, and they did not do that thing. So there are some examples, not many, but there's some. This is some. But the larger and the more subtle answer, just to quickly rattle through it, was that it's too simple to say yes or no. It's more about understanding how deliberations and governance unfold. And an administration that is deeply interested in the law and wants to think through everything and understand what the legal authority is, or at least could be, what legal arguments are available, and wants to justify what it's doing both to itself and to the world in recognizable legal arguments, is forced to think through issues that the law raises. And even if the law doesn't dictate the outcome, and military and diplomatic and political and policy considerations are as important, the law can bend and discipline those deliberations towards particular directions. So, for example, and this is going to, does it matter, right? So, for example, when they discover that Osama bin Laden is probably living in this compound in Abbottabad in Pakistan, the question becomes, what should we do about it? And an early proposition on the table is bomb that compound. Just bomb it to smithereens is the easiest, cleanest way to solve the problem. And of course, they don't end up doing that. And part of the deliberations that steer them away from that towards a higher risk commando raid where Americans could have been killed or captured was the legal consideration of collateral damage. This compound was in the middle of a residential neighborhood. Many, probably over 100 totally innocent people who had no idea that bin Laden was even there would die as well because they would need to hit the compound with a bomb big enough to take out tunnels underneath. Now, the lawyers were prepared, and I tell that story at great length. I wrote about it in the New York Times as well, so many of the listeners may have already seen it. They were prepared to sign off on quite a lot of collateral damage because that's lawful in war if it's necessary and proportionate to the military aim. But even the discussions about how much civilian bystander death is acceptable focused the discussion on there's going to be a lot of civilian bystander death. And for both policy reasons, for policy reasons raised by the legal deliberations that sort of steered the conversation towards other options.
You know, what you're describing to me, I suspect some of the listeners and to me, it sounds a bit like the legal tail wagging the policy dog in some ways. And it goes both ways, right? There's both the restraining ourselves in certain actions that might actually be better policy judgments because they don't risk American lives as with the bin Laden case, or the converse, which is the view that if it's legal, it's okay no matter what. The instance that I'm thinking of that was the story you tell about the drone policy and how in an almost rush, the two lawyers in the OLC searched anywhere they could for a precedent that would avoid the implications of what seemed to be an absolute ban on killing Americans overseas. So, two questions there. First, do you think that this is that the real way to capture the distinction is in the Obama administration, law trumps policy, and in the Bush administration, policy trumps law? Is that a fair characterization? And second, do you think that focus on law kind of distorts the debate some?
Well, I think that to your first question, that's too simplistic for me to embrace that. It's more like law influences policy and law concerns about the law saturate policy deliberations along with these other factors without actually dictating outcomes. In both administrations, we've now had two post-9/11 presidencies and they each have their own quirks. But I think that you see a recurring dynamic which underscores why national security law is so interesting and so important at this moment in our history, which is that when there is a fear of terrorism, especially, you know, in a moment like right now, post-Paris and San Bernardino, or right after 9/11, or the episode that opens my book, the nearly successful underwear bombing of a plane over Detroit on Christmas in 2009, which I think was a crucial moment for hardening Obama's approach to certain things. There is a great deal of pressure on government officials to do everything they can to prevent another attack, both for high reasons, which you don't want innocent people killed, and low reasons, which is the, you know, blame avoidance that you were in charge and you left an arrow in your quiver and now we've been attacked and why didn't you fire that arrow? And in that climate, the push to the pressure to do anything and everything the lawyers say is permissible can be quite strong. And that means that there's a risk that legal arguments or legal debate can substitute for policy debate about what is wise. Because once the lawyers say you can do it, you don't want to be the person who didn't do the thing and then we got attacked. And that's probably what led, for example, to the torture problems. And it's a great danger that people who are in power, I think we can see going forward, are need to be aware of and guard against.
Well, frame that for me in the context of the decision to authorize drone strikes against American citizens, which is the one I just referred to. That would seem to me not to fit into your paradigm of, you know, we've got to do absolutely everything. I would be surprised if they made that decision because they feared being critiqued for not sending a drone out to strike Al-Awlaki, right? So what drives that portion of the decision? What did you see there? And you know, talk us through a little bit about the legal analysis.
Okay. Well, so I mentioned that I think that a crucial episode for understanding many different aspects of this administration's post 9/11 record, or record on post 9/11 issues, I should say, was the Christmas underwear bombing attempt, and the sort of month that followed that of just a brutal political backlash and the election of Scott Brown in Massachusetts to the Ted Kennedy seat and the collapse of the political support in New York for bringing Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and other Guantanamo detainees to the Southern District for a civilian trial over 9/11 and many other things sort of flow out of that. One of the things that flows out of that was when Abdulmutallab tells his FBI interrogators in January of 2010 that Al-Awlaki, the radical Muslim cleric in Yemen and an American citizen, was an architect of the attack. It raises a tremendous dilemma. And it's Al-Awlaki is, if they decide, he's an operational terrorist at that point. He's not just a propagandist, as he had seemed to be up until then. He's trying to come up with plots to attack the United States. And one of the problems, of course, is we in the public have not seen the evidence for that. So we know it's sort of secondhand and it may be incomplete. And I think they should be more transparent about that as an aside. But they come up with the scenario that he's in Yemen. He's in this rural areas where the government of Yemen doesn't really have a military or police force that's capable of arresting him. And Yemen has given the United States permission to bomb AQ positions from the air, but forbidden the United States from putting boots on the ground. And so that raises the question of, can he be targeted if he is spotted from a drone and his capture is infeasible? And so it falls to the Office of Legal Counsel in early 2010, then led by David Barron, who's now a judge in the First Circuit, to work through these issues. And they write a very quick memo that turns out to be incomplete. And then when they realize that they've overlooked a few hard questions, they go back and they write a very long memo. And I tell a lot of the story of that process. But their answer is eventually, yes, under these limited circumstances, it would be lawful to target this American citizen without a trial because he is a member, says the CIA, of Al-Qaeda, and he's a lawful target as part of the congressionally authorized war. And then they work through a lot of issues about whether the fact that he's a U.S. citizen changes that and ultimately decide it does not, including despite a statute that says Don't kill Americans overseas, and doesn't seem to have on its face an exception, and that's the law that they had overlooked. And they had to sort of reason their way around that without invoking the sort of Bush-like Article II override power, in part because David Baron and his colleague Marty Baron had just written this long Harvard Law Review article about critiquing the Bush theories in the light of history and concluding that they were way overblown, and that was not going to be the theory that they really wanted to invoke. In fact, Obama has largely stayed away for all the accusations that he's an imperial president himself. He's his own kind of one. He's largely stayed away from invoking Article II override theories, with the exception of the Bowie Bergdahl Taliban 5 prisoner exchange deal.
Mm-hmm. Well, that raises a whole host of questions about why he's been more measured and restrained in the national security sphere than people perceive him over in the domestic sphere. But
absolutely. That's one of the great mysteries, as George W. Will has George F. Will has said in one of his columns, and I grapple with that myself in the book in the part towards the end where I'm reflecting on his executive power record, which, with the exception of probably his Libya policy in 2011, is the aggression is heavily centered in domestic policy, whether it's immigration policy or not defending the Defense of Marriage Act and so forth. And so Will says this is one of the paradoxes. Presidents have much more power traditionally abroad in foreign affairs than they do in domestic policy, and Obama seems to invert that. He's much more aggressive in making executive power claims domestically than he is in foreign policy. And I think from my discussions with Obama's advisors, the current and former and so forth, I think I understand why. It is because first of all, I think he truly believes in his domestic policies. You may not, or I may not, but he truly does. He's not conflicted about them, whereas he's always conflicted about war and sort of seeing the downsides of using violence. And so that leads to some hesitation. But I think also his lawyerly mindset and his appreciation for constraint as something that legitimizes and so forth has led him to the conclusion that in the domestic sphere, because what the executive branch is doing is out in the open, because it's much easier for Congress to challenge it or for individual plaintiffs to have standing to challenge it in court, the president is justified in pushing his powers to the limit because there are countervailing forces and the process can work its way out. And because there are so few countervailing forces abroad in the national security foreign policy sphere, because of what the president is doing is secret and no one has standing to bring lawsuits and so forth, it's important for a president to find and respect constraints on his authority and those of his successors.
That's interesting. I'm not sure it persuades me, but at least it explains it a bit. We're going to go to the phones in just a second. I have one more question for you, though.
Sure.
Actually, I have many more, but I have only one more I'm going to ask here, which is that you said in your opening, you've said a couple of times since, that you had kind of a remarkable opportunity to have fairly candid exchanges with a lot of the president's advisors in preparing your book. I, for one, was rather surprised at how much detail you got and how much was spoken about things that I would have considered to fall inside the realm of either deliberative process privileges or even classified material. I want to marry that observation to something that you talk about in the book, which is the extremes to which the administration has gone in prosecuting leakers. And I want to ask you actually this question. Do you find it harder to do your job now because of that, or is that about something else and the people at the high level are not paying attention to it?
Well, I think that most of the information you're going to find in this book may be arguably subject to attorney-client privilege. I don't know that there's that much I would say that is currently classified, with the exception maybe of a chapter I have, in which I piece together lots that have come out because of the Snowden leaks into sort of a coherent history of the development of surveillance law and technology between FISA 1978 and Obama taking office. A lot of that stuff may still be classified, but that's not in my head because someone in the government put it there. It's in my head because Edward Snowden made it public. Well, with some, you know, I did some additional reporting, of course. So you can't be prosecuted for disclosing attorney-client privileged information. It's a sort of a different thing. I do have a chapter, as you mentioned, that focuses on this administration's extraordinary record in prosecuting leakers. It's, at this point, if you count David Petraeus, prosecuted 9 such cases of disclosing government secrets for public edification, and all previous presidents from George Washington to George W. Bush had prosecuted 3 in some. So there's obviously been a sea change there. Part of the chapter tries to explain what these cases are and sort of what their behind-the-scenes bureaucratic background was, and it tries to make sense of how this happened. And I went looking for the meeting or the memo where Obama or Eric Holder or someone deliberately decided to do this. And, you know, I said, there's too much leaking. Let's get me some heads on spikes. Because when you see a change like that, you want it to make sense. You want it to be a choice and a policy decision. And I came to the maybe surprising conclusion that it was not a choice that anyone deliberately made. This administration certainly kept its foot off the brakes as these cases were developing. But there was no moment where they decided affirmatively to go out and try to do it. And that the real explanation is metadata, speaking of Ed Snowden. Today we are all leaving trails of who we've been in contact with in a way that was not true 10 or 20 years ago even, in such that it is much easier now for the FBI to assemble a strong circumstantial case that the only person who had, or the only 5 or 6 people who were, both had a social relationship with the reporter, that is, they had sent or received a phone call or an email with that reporter at some point, and had access to the specific piece of information that leaked, was this very small list of people. And that's investigatable and means that cases today are viable that were not viable before.
So do you find yourself going old school, back to pen and paper?
Well, I find myself talking to many, 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 many people. You know, if you can't hide the, if you can't erase the needle, you can at least create a haystack. So that and that's, you know, and I mentioned this book is based on 150 plus different people that I spoke with, and that means that, you know, how do you tie any particular thing to any particular person? But I think the implications of 21st century electronic communication metadata for investigative journalism are profound, and we haven't really fully grappled with them yet. And what's sort of depressing about this insight is it wasn't something Obama did or that Bush had decided to do and set in motion before him. Bush did have a very aggressive leak task force. That is the explanation of 2 of the 9 cases, but not the other 7, is that it can't be turned off. You know, it's just the way things are in the 21st century.
Okay. That sounds like a good place to at least pause for a moment. Dean, you want to open up the lines?
Yeah. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. As we're waiting to see who dials in, a reminder to our audience to check our website for a schedule of upcoming Teleforum conference calls. We'll have a few of them next week. They're all available on our website. Also, if you haven't signed up for our weekly email announcing the calls, you should do so, and you can do that on our website as well. Today, of course, the title of the book we're discussing is Power Wars, Inside Obama's Post-9/11 Presidency, with Mr. Paul Rosenzweig and the book's author, Mr. Charlie Savage. We've got 2 questions pending at this point, so let's take our first call of the day.
Hello, this is John McGinnis from Northwestern Law School. I'm interested in as a former Deputy Assistant Attorney General at the Office of Legal Counsel, the role of the Office of Legal Counsel in the Obama administration, at least in 2 instances. that I know of, it seems to have been circumvented in a way that I find surprising as an alumnus of the office. The first was a domestic one in which the question of the constitutionality of making the District of Columbia a state, we all see so that could not be done, and Eric Holder ran around them to the Solicitor General's office and said they would defend that, and therefore they took the position in to Congress that was that legislation was not unconstitutional. Secondly, and more relevantly for your book, as I understand it, in the large question of the Obama, of the Bin Laden raid, the question of the legality of that and never went to OLC. I can say without disclosing any matters is that OLC was very much involved in national security matters, including specific ones that require classified information in previous administrations. And so I'm wondering whether there's a different role, and this suggests that there's some forum shopping going on. And then finally, the final question I would ask, the press was always very critical if it seemed that the legality, the normal process wasn't working in the legal regime in the Republican administrations. But I've not really heard much focus on the role or the diminishment, if that is the case, of the Office of Legal Counsel.
Great. So thanks for calling in. And you could have added a third example, which I also explore at length in this book, which was the deliberations in 2011 about what to do in Libya as day 60 of the intervention neared, and there was no congressional authorization for the air campaign, and the administration was struggling with whether the war powers resolution meant that it needed to stop or at least throttle back its contribution to the NATO operation, and ultimately decided not to make any changes. And as I tell that story at length in this book and had previously reported in the Times, OLC had a different view that something did need to be throttled back, and the White House just chose not to go with that interpretation of the law in that instance. And you, there are these those are the three I know about, where the Bin Laden one is just the Justice Department, including Eric Holder, and as well as OLC, weren't even told that the operation was in the works. There's just sort of these process foul movements. I would say it is correct that OLC, especially after 2010, in this administration, has had a different role than we are familiar with from the Bush years, where OLC is kind of the final authority and the questions go to OLC and people don't mess with OLC when OLC says it's like this or like that, which may have its own dysfunctions depending on whether the person leading OLC has a mainstream understanding of what the law is, especially in these questions where the legal debate of whether something can be done substitutes for the policy debate of whether it should be done. This administration has had something, has filtered its very heavily legalized deliberations through a different model. It has used what it calls the interagency lawyers group to vet stuff that was going to go through the NSC legal NSC deliberation process at every step, not just NSC meetings, but principals meetings, deputies meetings, and even working group meetings. And the Interagency Lawyers Group is a body that is chaired by the NSC legal advisor, but it includes the top lawyer for the State Department and the Joint Chiefs and the Defense Department and OLC and a couple other places, CIA. And that group is sort of like a brain trust. And as opposed to OLC standing alone, they might be asked from time to time to write the authoritative memo. It's more like this council of councils from all the different agencies is the place where consensus is sought and debates unfold. The Interagency Lawyers Group goes back to the Bush-Quayle administration, and it sort of grew when the NSC legal advisor position was first created after Iran-Contra, And it's by executive order, it's supposed to look at covert actions. And it, during the Clinton years, it had started to take on a larger role. During the Bush-Cheney years, it was more or less put back in a very small role. And it was more like the Office of the Vice President would ask OLC, can we do this? And no one else even knew that the issue was in play. This administration revived and expanded its role, and I would say that that has been a different model than the OLC-centric role that we are familiar with from the Bush years.
Is it fair, Charlie, to say that one of the reasons behind that is the proliferation of lawyers elsewhere? OLC's preeminence often was because it was the go-to lawyer group. If you have a lot of other lawyers, including the president and vice president himself, they might very well feel comfortable with their own legal analysis.
They might. There's always been a lot of lawyers elsewhere. It's more like, do they get invited to the meeting and told what's going on? Right, which would be the problem if there was a problem in the Bush years, especially in the first term. I think that this interagency lawyers group model was a deliberate decision by Tom Donilon, who during the transition in 2008, Donilon is a lawyer himself. He eventually became Obama's national security advisor, probably his most important one, but started off as just his deputy national security advisor. But he was going to have the legal policy surrounding counterterrorism issues portfolio from the beginning. And he had studied the Bush administration, among other organizations, and had come to the conclusion that its lack of fully ventilating issues among all the contributing voices with equities in a matter was a dysfunction that did not serve President Bush well. For example, as Condi Rice has written in her memoirs, she did not even know. She was the national security advisor, of course, in Bush's first term. She did not even know, and her lawyer, John Bellinger, did not even know that the idea of creating military commissions was on the table until Bush had already signed the order put in front of him by Vice President Cheney to create them, and they learn about it from the media later that day. And so this process was created as the antidote or the reaction or arguably the overreaction to that kind of situation. They were going to really make sure that everyone and all the different agencies had a chance to weigh in before they made any changes to the status quo or went forward with the proposal. And you know, one of the conclusions I draw in the book from that is that there's an ironic or counterintuitive consequence of that kind of process where you got to have consensus among everybody before you move forward. And if someone objects, then you just bump it up to the next higher level in the NSA process. And in that it has a very strong status quo bias. Anyone can veto, whether it's should we get rid of military commissions or whether should we let this particular person out of Guantanamo. If nine people in the room say yes, but one from the intelligence community or whoever says, I don't know, then the commission stay or the guy stays in Guantanamo. And that's one of the part of the explanation as well for why this administration has had a surprising degree of continuity with the last administration, which is that its very lawyerliness made it very difficult to dislodge the new status quo that the Bush administration had created by blowing through process in some degree.
We've got just one caller question pending. If you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. For now, let's take another call from our audience.
Hi, Charlie. This is Kurt Levy with Committee for Justice.
Hi, Kurt.
Enjoyed your talk. The Obama administration has a big national security / rule of law decision coming up, and that's whether to prosecute Hillary Clinton. Assuming the FBI finds she broke the law, and I think most observers believe she did to at least some extent, do you think that the Attorney General will follow the rule of law and prosecute, or are their political stakes just too high to expect the rule of law to govern, in your opinion?
My goodness, Kurt.
that's a softball there, Charlie.
Go ahead. I don't know that there is the consensus that you see that she personally broke the law. What would it be? She operated an email system that...
Oh, no, I was talking about the... I think she probably violated departmental policy, but no, I was talking about, the type of stuff of Petraeus did with not necessarily any evil intent, disclosing classified material.
Well, she was received it. That's different than disclosing it. And she received it from other people who also had clearances. You know, so if one person with a clearance, I'm just trying to think it through with you here, right? So if person A who has a clearance to receive authorized or classified information sends it to person B who also has a security clearance, you would prosecute person B for having received it through the incorrect method. What is the statute you think that violates?
You're way more of an expert than I am on this, but I thought that you were limited in the means of transmission, that you're not just allowed to sort of take things home with you and, you know, talk about them on an unsecured phone with someone else who has a security clearance. I mean, if I'm wrong, and that is legal.
Well, there's all kinds of rules involving classified information. But those are administrative rules. The statutory constraints are much more limited. They usually have to do with disclosure. You're right. I believe there is a statute, which is the one that General Petraeus was eventually pled to.
And Sandy Berger.
Which has to do with, was it reckless? In any case, I thought you were going to bring up something different, which was when you said they have a huge legal and policy national security decision pending before them, and if you'll indulge me. To me, what the most fascinating question right now for who Obama has turned out to be and will be remembered as in this area is centers around closing Guantanamo. He's obviously wanted to close Guantanamo since he was a candidate. It was one of his first vows as president, the order that they were going to do it for a year. Within a year. They failed to do that, and then he signed legislation by Congress that says it's illegal to bring detainees onto U.S. soil. And I think that it's pretty clear to anyone that this Congress is not going to give him the policy win of changing that statute. And he is going to be faced, therefore, a year from now with a dilemma. And the dilemma is, A, he will just have policy failure, and Guantanamo will still be open with prisoners in it when he leaves office. Or B, he could make the claim, as he did in a more limited way in the Bergdahl-Taliban trade, that he is the commander-in-chief and Congress lacks constitutional authority to impede him if he thinks that wartime prisoners are better held somewhere else than Guantanamo, say Charleston or Fort Leavenworth or Florence, Colorado, where the Supermax is.
Do you think that would be a complete repudiation of what's gone before? I mean, in terms of his sense of rule of law?
Well, this is why I'm so fascinated by it, right? Because he could solve his problem, but only by making a Bush-like claim about Article II override theory. And then so he's either going to be – unless something else changes or they've figured out some other solution that is not in front of us now. And so he could either be – if he's thinking about his presidential museum in the history books, be the guy who said he was going to close Gitmo and dithered for too long and then failed to do it, or he could be the guy who did it but only did it by becoming the president he didn't want to be. At the beginning of my book tour, I went on Morning Joe on MSNBC, and Joe Scarborough opened it by saying, this is the book about how Obama became the commander-in-chief that he hated, which is way too unsubtle for me. And I was like, I don't know. But it would have been probably make it a more marketable book if that had been the subtitle. But if he does go out by clearly saying he's the commander-in-chief and he can blow through a statutory constraint like that in order to close Gitmo. That should be the end of the book, right? But I have already written it, and so it'll have to be the paperback or something. But that dilemma, I think, is totally fascinating.
So do you have an answer for Kurt's original question?
Yeah,
I don't have an answer for that original question. Sorry, Kurt.
No. And let me just clarify. I did not mean that rhetorically. Let me change assuming she broke the law to if the FBI finds she broke the law. I really do think that's an interesting question. And I mean, because you seem to have more faith in the administration following the rule of law than I do, I mean, it did, you know, it did get me thinking. I mean, is this a case where the rule of law will overcome politics? And, you know, I know you don't know the answer, but I just was interested in hearing your thoughts.
Well, I did the best I could.
Okay.
Well, gentlemen, we don't have any questions pending from our audience. Let me make another call for questions. If you'd like to ask a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got about 10 minutes left, time for at least another question.
I've got one if nobody comes up on your list there, Dean.
Go right ahead, Paul.
Okay, so Charlie, I want to take a small little episode out of your book and ask you a couple questions. You tell the story about how the head of OLC, Virginia Seitz, wrote a memo about the recess appointment power, which was then relied upon by the president to make some recess appointments. You know, substantively, of course, in the end, the Supreme Court rejected that. But my question is really about the public disclosure of that opinion. You report that when it came to be known when that was published, I think it was Senator Grassley, I'm not sure if I remember exactly, he said, that's a horrible memo, and Ms. Seitz is never going to be confirmed for anything again, pretty much. You know, your perspective as a reporter is obviously that OLC opinions and things like this ought to be generally public because they frame a good debate and they make good news, but they also inform the American public. I look at that and I say that if I'm Virginia Seitz or anybody else in that position, I never write anything on paper again. Not unless I'm willing to be have my personal career, you know, killed.
So I, you know, this book and much of what I do for a living is centered around the idea of bringing to public light what the legal debate is and the legal thinking is behind closed doors inside the executive branch. And I think that especially in not necessarily in the recess appointment land, but in national security land, it's incredibly important because of that factor I mentioned earlier about the legal debate often substituting for a policy debate in this very fraught realm, because it may be that when the lawyers are trying to decide whether something can be done, that is the only moment in which the country is actually deciding whether to do that thing. And by the time the country finds out later on, the horse is out of the barn. And just because I think in a representative democracy and a continuing, you know, experiment in self-government, it's just crucial for the public to understand what the law is. And in this realm, the executive branch legal team, whether it's this administration or the last or the next, is making a lot of law in realms where things are very often not justiciable and never going to come before a court for any kind of definitive ruling. And I reflect a lot about this sort of weird beast of executive branch lawyering. So the counter to that. And so I'm trying to figure out what they're doing. I'm suing them under the Freedom of Information Act to pull things out into the public light, like the memo about the targeted killing of Anwar Aleki. And I'm pressuring them to either through the front door or individual people through the back door to tell me at least what they're thinking so I can explain to the public this is what's in play. And the counter to that is what happened to Virginia Seitz, right? If they say something controversial, it'll be subject that lawyer to political attacks. The lawyer will be afraid that he or she will never get confirmed to be a judge someday. It will chill the candor of legal deliberations. And that's not a completely farcical excuse, because Virginia Seitz will probably never be a judge. And as a OLC head, she probably would really like to be a judge, just as David Barron is a judge, just as Jade Bybee is a judge. So the question is, will ambitious lawyers want to go into the executive branch legal team or OLC, or will they shy away? Or if they are there, will they pull their punches and not provide the president with a legal advice that goes right up to the limit of what is legally available, if that's what he needs to hear or she needs to hear? I think that the recess appointment controversy is a good illustration about why you might not, why it might be a good thing for executive branch lawyers to pull their punches a little bit. There, OLC said the president could declare that these pro forma sessions by the Senate during their long winter break were a sham. They weren't really available to take up nominations during that 2 or 3 week period, and so he could go ahead and just make recess appointments. And all 9 justices on the Supreme Court, including 2 of Obama's appointees, reject that theory. Say the Senate's in session when it says it's in session, and they're not going to look behind that. So a greater caution from the Justice Department would have, in hindsight, clearly have been warranted in that situation.
So maybe Grassley isn't being mean to her. He's actually accurately reflecting the fact that if you're that poor a lawyer or that willing to bend for political reasons, you shouldn't be a judge.
Well, I mean, without casting judgment on whether that's what Virginia did in that instance, it's clear that that's how that episode's going to be remembered because it was a 9-0 Supreme Court case. And maybe the other solution is you don't put young, ambitious lawyers in OLC. Maybe you put people at the end of their career at OLC so they have the independence both of not caring that they're never going to be a judge because they're never going to be a judge anyway, or also the independence of being willing to resign if they're asked by the White House to do something they think is unlawful because they're at the end of their career anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's a place for wise old lawyers, not ambitious young lawyers.
Dean, you got anybody in the queue, or should I move on to something else?
Go right ahead. The floor is open, but we have no pending questions.
Guys who are listening, you guys are cueless. What can I say? I'm sorry. That was just a good joke.
Did you say cueless?
Yeah. Sorry. So last question now. And I'm going to go back to Gitmo. And you're talking about the president's desire to close it. I want to marry that, which is you describe it great length in the book, to the reality that the president has just authorized special operations forces to go back into Syria and Iraq, and from my perspective, the near certainty that we're going to wind up with new captives on the field of battle of the sort, some of whom will be of the sort that formerly went to Gitmo. Your prediction on A, how the Obama administration is going to approach the legal question of what to do with these people, so the process question, and B, what you think the right what their answer is going to be, not the right answer, but their answer.
Well, even before this, Obama has brought 0 new people to Guantanamo, and although plenty of people have been targeted for killing with drones, the United States has also captured some people since Obama became president who were not brought to Gitmo. And that was, we've talked a lot about the continuities between the second-term Bush administration approach and the Obama administration approach. One of the great places in which he's really gone off on a different way is what do you do with new captures? And he developed what people sometimes call the Warsami model. When I say he, I obviously mean the many people working for him, whereby if you take someone in your custody, because it's such a pain to have detainees, the preference is if they're in a country that can handle them, you let that country handle them. So I would expect that prisoners in the emerging ISIS war will largely be handed to the Iraqi government.
But they're in Syria, right?
Well, the Iraqi government is part of that, right? That conflict. But we'll see. I don't know. The Warsami model is, if it's in that case, it was a guy picked up who was Somali and had been in Yemen, and neither of those governments were really capable of dealing with prisoners, and so there was no other place to send him, and so we were going to have to deal with him. They developed the model of putting him, someone like that, on a ship or somewhere else and interrogating them for intelligence purposes for a month or two without lawyers, without torture either. And then when the interrogation was done, transitioning to a civilian law enforcement model, because in practice, military commissions simply, I think, self-evidently have not worked very well, and prosecuting them through Article 3 procedures, which are all very well established. And that model has, in practice, the lived experience of that is that it's been quite effective in both getting intelligence from detainees, but also providing a long-term disposition option that is stable and does not lead to the headaches and the frictions of either long-term indefinite detention under the laws of war or the continuing attempt to make military commissions work. So I think that model could continue if they capture some people that they think for some reason the Iraqi government can't handle, I would say predictably.
Okay. Dean, we got time for another, or are we reaching the end here?
We are at the end of our allotted time. If you both have time for more questions, we could take one final question.
Well, I'm just going to ask you this one. I've spoken to a couple of my former colleagues in the Bush administration, and some of them seem to be experiencing moments of schadenfreude here. And this goes back to something that John McGinnis asked about, which is they see the procedural exclusion of OLC from some critical decisions. You talk about the Libya decision in the book as, you know, kind of almost a retrospective justification for the conduct in the Bush administration. How would the Obama people who excluded OLC from the bin Laden decision, say, or the Libya decision, react to that comparison?
Interesting. The vindication.
Yeah, well,
Right. OLC wasn't excluded from the Libya decision. They just their advice, their interpretation of what the best interpretation of the War Powers Resolution was not embraced by the president.
Right.
They were excluded from the bin Laden raid, and that they didn't even know it was happening and were not invited to the meetings to offer input. I don't have a great answer to that. Is this vindication for the times when John Ashcroft wasn't told what was going on? Or does it maybe vindication is the wrong word, but it means that those who, Democrats who self-righteously pointed the finger and it turned out to sometimes be messier in governance than when they were making those attacks. This has been a messy time, and I don't know. I'm not defending. I'm just trying to bring to the surface and explain. So if people want to make that use of the stories I'm bringing to light. That's what I can. All I have to offer.
I'm not trying to defend either, but I do sense that some people see a retrospective vindication for their procedural unilateralism. So we've been talking with Charlie Savage, Power Wars, Inside Obama's Post 9/11 Presidency. It is the perfect stocking stuffer for the policy wonk in your family.
It might rip your stocking apart.
I was going to say, the only problem with it is that at 700-plus pages, it's a little too big for the stockings, at least in my house. But nonetheless, buy it, put it under the tree. If you are interested in national security law, it's a great book to read.
Thank you, Paul.
Thanks, Charlie, for joining us.
And this is Dean Reuter thanking both Paul Rosenzweig and Charlie Savage for joining us here today. And also to the audience, thank you for dialing in and for your attention and your questions as well. A reminder to our audience to check the website for the schedule of upcoming Teleforum conference calls. But until the next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.